everyone. Bob Main from Handgun World, another YouTube episode, another audio episode. I'm a practical guy. This is a practical show. Episode 646, for some of you that have been listening to me all these years, like my guest, and even if you are new listeners, thank you. I want to do a quick shout out to my international listeners. I've been getting some emails that have been coming to me from all over the world. I don't know why people outside of USA, but, you know, I suppose they tune in to learn something as well, so I'm flattered by that. And Dave Somm, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. Thank you. Good to be back.
You know, the last interview that we did a couple of weeks ago, I got some real good reviews on it, so I'm happy to have you back. We talked a little bit last time about defining your concealed carry mission, and any of you viewers that have never listened, go over to my website, Handgun World, or you can find me on Apple Podcasts, or you can find this pretty much anywhere that you get your podcasts. So we're going to do a little part two on that. But before we get to that, you said you wanted to give a range report on your Smith & Wesson M&P range session.
Yeah, so here's my M&P. It's not a shield. It's a little bigger. It's the compact size, Glock 19 size. I can get all my...
Get your entire hand on that thing.
So you can get your pinky in there, get that involved.
I forgot to ask, is that the 2.0 or the original version?
This is the 2.0 compact. Okay. So it is it's like a Glock 19, 15-round magazine, 4-inch barrel, double stack.
All right, but, yeah, so, very popular pistol, very good pistol. And you recently took it to the range. You got a good report for us.
Yeah. So it's been a little while since I've got to shoot it. I spend a lot of time doing dry fire. But, you know, if we're going to be shooting these things, we need to be able to hit our target. And on this one, I don't know if you can see.
Very well. We can see that very well.
Okay. So we've got Trijicon HD XR, which is skinny front sight post. It's a very good sighting system. You can, as you're coming up, you can get that front sight. But at longer ranges, you have to work on it. And as you will learn as you shoot, different bullet weights, different sights, they all kind of interact differently. And so if you're going to be accurate, you need to know. So a couple of weeks ago, I was able to go to the range. It was just over at lunch break. So it wasn't a really long session. But I thought, I should get some shooting done. And I went, and they have it's a public range run by the state. They have a 50-foot pistol range.
50 feet, okay.
Yeah. So, you know, you figure it's about 15 yards. That's about 45 feet. So
yeah, it's more like about 16 to 17. But, yeah, that's give or take a little bit. Who cares, right? Who's counting?
Pretty close. Yeah, it's close enough. It's close enough. So... I went and I had some leftover hollow point ammo, which is, you should change it out periodically. So I had a big bag of just old ammo that, you know, just needed to shoot it. And then I shot about 5 rounds of my new current ammo, which is Federal HST 124 grain plus P ammo.
There we go. I got the same.
Yeah. So it's got
my favorite carry ammo.
Yeah, it's a nice medium weight. It's got plus P, so it's got some oomph behind it. And I've heard people say good things about it. So I went and I was using a B8 target.
Okay.
Some knowledgeable people have said that they like these because the targeting area, it's a 5-inch circle. It's about, you know, the right size here and like the right size here. So if you're doing it for defensive purposes, this is a good target.
That's a good illustration there, Dave. That's good.
Yeah. So I was shooting at one of those, and I realized that the sights on these Trijicon sights, they are different than the sights that are on my SIG, which I've had for a very, very long time. The sights on my SIG, let's see if you imagine, here's the front sight, mm-hmm. and here's like the dot. the bullet wants to hit kind of right in down in the middle, but the sights on the Trigicon, on my M&P, they like to shoot high. So you have to take it and line up the front sight post with the back, and then put the top of the sight post right about here to get it in here.
So some people call that about a 6 o'clock hold.
Yeah, I would say that's a 6 o'clock hold with plus P ammo. When I switched to some ammo that was some, I got some bulk range ammo. And when I switched to that, all of a sudden, the rounds were hitting exactly like right in line with the top of the front sight. So then instead of having the top of the front sight down here, I had to move it up to here.
So why do you think that is? Why do you think that you're shooting high with the plus P Federal 124 grain?
I'm not 100% sure, but I did notice it was pretty consistent as long as I was pulling the trigger correctly, which that's another issue. But it could be if it's throwing the bullet faster, maybe it has a sharper recoil. And so maybe the barrel is slightly higher when it shoots with the plus P.
Well, I'm not sure. The bullet's probably left the barrel by the time you feel the recoil. I would say that's probably, unless somebody wants to correct me on that. But what I like to hear you say is that you tested it both ways. Some people don't test both types of ammo.
Yeah. Yeah. So like, let's say I was able to find some plus P ammo, but then when it's time to get new ammo, all I can find is like standard pressure ammo. I would need to take that new ammo to the range and make sure I know where it's hitting if I want to be accurate.
Very good point. So here's something I want to continue this, but here's something I want to throw out. When ammo was scarce 2-3 years ago, I was buying up just whatever I could find.
Right.
And that's typical of a lot of people. Unless you stock a lot of ammo, you have to buy what you can find. So I went to the range on Saturday as well, and I decided that I settle on the same ammo you do, Federal HST 124 grain. I use standard pressure instead of plus P, but here's what I'm starting to do. I used a couple different types of ammo. I used Hornady, and the other one was Spear. I didn't like where the bullets were going. I liked where they were going with Federal. So what I plan to do is I'm switching everything out to Federal HST. I'm gonna shoot and practice with all the other concealed carry ammo that I have until I get down to the amount I want and maybe buy some more of the Federal. What do you think?
I mean, that's a good idea. Get something that works well. And if you're, you know, if you're serious about this, if you're going to be reaching out to distances beyond 7 yards, then you're going to need to know those details of where the ammo hits. And, you know, I've met trainers who were police officers, and they have absolute faith in the ability of Federal HST 124 grain to like work.
And what distance were you shooting at?
So I decided for this shooting range session, I decided to just leave it all at 50. Just do it hard, make it hard, see how
50
see,
feet.
You know, make a challenge for myself. And so yeah, it was I was
so fine. Everything I, was I, done at 50 feet. All of your shots.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So I would put the sights about here.
Lift that up a little bit. Ammo. Lift it up.
Oh just yeah. Sorry.
There you go. You'd put the sights where?
Just right about on this line here, or as close as I could see, you know, with the naked eye at 50 feet. But I was putting the top of the sight here, and then as long as I had a good trigger press, I was getting pretty close in here.
And with range practice ammo, where was it hitting?
I would have to braise the front sight up to about here, and then the range practice ammo, which was some older standard pressure, and then I had some American Eagle. I got a 1,000-round case that I plan to make use of. So, and that's standard pressure, And I would have to bring the front sight up to about here to be able to.
So it sounds like your standard pressure was hitting pretty close to point of aim, point of impact, your range ammo.
Yeah.
But your carry ammo, the Federal HST, was shooting high.
Yeah. So if I was going to, you know, practice aiming, I would want to have the dot of the front sight down a little bit low to hit above, and I haven't tested it at like 5 yards. At 5 yards, the distance probably closes.
It you probably just put closes. The dot in the middle,
you're good there.
Well, this is good stuff. This is the way I think that people should practice with a gun they carry.
Yeah. And this was something I could do at the range. So I'm not allowed to draw at this range because it's state operated. So they don't want people working from the holster. They don't want you firing more than one round a second because just, you know, anybody can be there and they don't want people going crazy, which I get. So I just had a timer on my phone, just an app, and I set it to like 2 seconds. And I would start in kind of the number three position, practice, you know, getting the gun out, getting the sights on target, and trying to break that shot in under 2 seconds. And I found that that's probably a little too fast. I could probably slow down a little bit. And then I would find that I would get on target and then be anticipating the shot, so I'd flinch. And instead of taking out the slack and then doing a nice easy click, I was just wham all the way.
But that's
through.
Okay though.
That's okay. But at 50 feet, it amplifies, you know, any mistakes you make. So.
But you know, a lot of good shooters, I hear them say that's the way you should shoot. I hear a lot of really high level shooters that say they don't shoot to reset, as I call it. They're completely off the trigger and back on it again in a fraction of a second, or they at least let the trigger all the way out, you know, instead of shooting to reset to make sure. Yeah. So what they'll do is, you know, after they fire, a lot of them are like this, off and back on.
Yeah.
That's what I hear. That's not me. For some reason, maybe I'm doing it the wrong way. But I'll fire, and then I will just go right back to reset like that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it was taught like that for a long time. So, and me too. I think it's just habit, especially when I'm only doing one shot and I'm trying to like have good follow through. You know, I catch myself trapping the trigger. But if I had to remind myself of what we learn, and because you've taken a Mag 42. The way that Masoud Ayoub teaches, you know, because obviously when you pull the trigger and the rounds are hitting low and left, it's because you are pulling the gun down. You're squeezing on the grip right as you're about to pull the trigger. So Masoud's Mass's solution is just squeeze it as hard as you can as your grip. Like he calls it the vice grip, or crush grip. So I had to remind myself, all right, crush the grip, clamp it in there hard, and then that minimizes that, you know, kind of flinch kind of grabbing motion. And so a lot of the stuff I've done in dry fire, it helps you remind you what it's supposed to feel like when you do it properly. But then when you get to the range, you get recoil, and you have to remember how to manage recoil and not to flinch and clamp down on it and all that stuff. So it's always a good learning experience to,
Recoil messes things up, doesn't it, Dave?
Yeah. It surprises you a little bit. Like, yeah, it shouldn't, but it does. And the only conclusion I have every time I go to the range is, man, I need to get out here more and practice more.
That's what my conclusion was on Saturday. I want to touch a little bit more on something we've just been talking about. I hear a lot of people say dry fire practice. You got to dry fire practice all the time. That's true. You do have to dry fire practice. But I don't believe that anything beats live fire. Because live fire introduces the recoil. It introduces the noise. It introduces the shock. And experienced shooters that I think have been shooting a long time may not be as intimidated. In fact, probably are not as intimidated by the recoil and the noise. But especially new shooters. You know, new shooters can be at home and they can do this all they want and dry fire and dry fire. But that gun's not moving much when you're doing this. All right? Yeah. But you get to the range and all of a sudden the recoil, especially when you put your plus P in there, boy, now you got a lot of recoil going on, don't you?
Yeah. I figure with dry fire, you can work probably 80 to 90% of the fundamentals of handling the gun safely, you know, practice getting it out of the holster, keep your finger off the trigger until you're aimed, and then, you know, the sights, touch, take the slack out, or you know, sights, grip, and then press.
Correct.
You can work a lot on that in dry fire so that you know, so you kind of know what you're supposed to be doing, and then it's fewer things to think about when the gun starts actually going off and it's loud. And
I 100% agree with that, and I'm not knocking dry fire. I do it. I practice not only pressing the trigger, but drawing. I even practice different scenarios. I practice movement and things like that when I'm doing dry fire. If there's a new technique I learned, I'll do that in dry fire. But boy, there's nothing beats getting out to the range and pressing the trigger 200 times with live rounds, is there?
For sure. Yeah, nothing beats it. And especially the more often you can go, I think the more that learning curve is smaller, and you can actually get in and do some good work.
What else about your M&P 2.0 compact did you learn at the range?
Well, a couple of times I might be gripping it where my thumb is down, because a couple of times when the magazine ran empty, it went right back and I got a click. And so I was like, oh, that's interesting. So I'm going to have to probably incorporate some malfunction drills in, maybe do a few of those, remind myself of those. But yeah, that was pretty interesting. I did some with, you know, both hands, and then I did some of the single hand techniques that we learned from Mag 40 from Masada Yub, and of course I did all those out at 50 feet, just, you know, to make it hard.
So do you mean that you had a few times where the slide did not lock back after the first round? I mean the last round.
Yeah, the final round. Yeah, so I don't know if it's the springs in the magazine are weak, maybe
possibly
need to be replaced. I don't know, because on the 2.0.
Sounds to me like your thumb might have been riding the slide release.
I think I probably do, because so.
You might have been pressing that with your weak hand, right? Show me that grip again.
Yeah, so here's this. It's right there. So
you may have been hitting.
Probably just holding it down.
Yeah. And this is another reason to get to know what gun you're going to carry, because now, you know, okay, it didn't lock back on you after the last round a couple of times, but really now, how often do you think we're going to get to the last round in our gun?
I mean, hopefully not a lot, right?
Hopefully never. Yeah.
So, but it's something to consider. And
unless you have a revolver, unless you carry a J-frame.
Yeah, yeah, those are a whole different ballgame. But
then you don't have to worry about a slide. So who cares?
yeah. So I did that. I ended up probably total. I probably got about half of my. So my targeting area is just the black, the bullseye. And probably in total of all the rounds I fired, I probably had about half of them get into black. A lot of them were wide, but I was trying to reacquaint myself with the single-handed techniques. After a couple of magazines with my phone set at 2 seconds, I set the timer so it would give me a 3-second par time. So it would go beep and then beep again at 3 seconds. And I, like, forced myself to slow down and take longer to try and get my shot so that I wasn't trying to rush myself. Cause that's another thing. You get to the range, it's exciting. There's guns going off. You want to just like, rush and get it on there. And that's when I found when I was trying to push it too quickly, that's when my marksmanship suffered. And so
that usually happens.
Yeah. So it's not that, you know, it's good or bad. That's just kind of where I'm at right now, where I needed to slow down a little bit and concentrate on it. And I can work on my getting more accuracy in subsequent range trips, and then work on speed. And I'll probably find a range where I can just set up my own targets and do drawing and multiple shots and things like that. But for right now, it was a pretty productive range trip for a lunch break. And
good. You know, that's a great lunch break. I like that.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
That's up to practice. So,
Dave, a couple things before we stop the video. What do you like? What couple things do you like most about your M&P 2.0?
What I like about it the most. Well, so it's very ergonomic. It's got the 1911 kind of angle for the grip frame. So
18 degrees, I believe.
Right, like that. So it comes right up. It is, compared to my SIG, it's very thin and slim. So it just kind of, hard to describe. Like, I don't have to think too hard about it in my hands. It's just there, and all I have to think about is the front sight. And then the trigger, where it is, it's kind of single action. Because the trigger, all it does is it releases the striker. On a Glock, it catches the striker, pulls it back slightly, and releases. On the M&P, it just lets it go. So it's very much like a single action. So I like that it's thin. I like, especially with these sights, they're very high visibility.
They are.
You pick them up as you come up, and
those are good sights.
Yeah. So it's just kind of, I don't know. I want to say it's like, you don't have to think too hard about how you hold it, how you're aiming it. It's just gun out, you know, orange dot on bad thing, pull the trigger.
And that's a good thing. That's a good thing. We all have things that we probably don't like about some of the guns we have. Is there anything you don't like about that one?
It's minor, but the undercut of the trigger.
Yeah.
If you look, it's kind of rounded, but it's pretty flat. So sometimes the knuckle kind of hits that corner there. On my SIG 229, it's actually beveled this, and so it's smoother. It's more comfortable.
So you have Glock trigger on an M&P. I mean, Glock knuckle on an M&P.
Yeah. Yeah. It's undercut a little bit, but it still has a definite corner on the edge of the frame.
Some people call that Glock knuckle, where your knuckle's all kind of beat up and sore, and you got the same thing on an Smith & Wesson M&P.
Yeah, you get it a little bit. It's not bad, though.
It's not too bad, yeah. This Shadow Systems that I like, I don't know if you can see the undercut of that. Let me get it back over towards the camera. See that right there? Mm-hmm. See that that big undercut? So my finger really gets high up in there, and there's no Glock knuckle with these.
Yeah.
But comparing that to my 365, that one has not quite as deep. So I get a little bit more Glock knuckle, but not as bad on that one. But this is the Wilson Combat grip module, which has a much better undercut. And I don't have my standard module here with me, but it's got much better undercut, I believe, than the standard SIG grip module.
More finger-shaped.
More finger-shaped, yeah. Well, good. That's a good range report at 50 feet. That's I like the fact that you're practicing it at 50 feet. You know, so many people bring that target right up to 5 yards, you know, and they're going boom, 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 boom. Oh, look at my nice little group I got at 5 yards. Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
But I'd like to see people challenge yourself and get that thing out to 50 feet. Get that out to between 15 and 20 yards.
Yeah, I like the there's a drill that I think is probably like a baseline for most concealed carriers. you know, at varying different levels of skill. But it's called, I mean, it's really simple. The 5x5 drill. You put a timer for 5 seconds. This is a 5-inch circle. So like from here to here is 5 inches. You fire 5 shots and you want all of them to get inside the circle.
Yeah,
and
that's good.
You put it at 5 yards. So if you can get 5 shots inside this circle at 5 yards in 5 seconds, I think that's a good starting point.
That's great.
That's a good minimum.
That's a good drill, the 5. You talked about that the last time we interviewed, the 5x5 drill.
Yeah, I think if most people can get to that, that's a good starting place. And then from there, you can push it back and really see what you can do.
Good. I want to conclude the video. We're going to keep on talking more because we're going to spend some more time talking about defining our mission. We talked about that a couple of weeks ago. So for those of you watching on YouTube, thank you. Like this video. Subscribe to my channel. If you want to see more good interviews like this, support me on Patreon. There'll be a link below that on the video. You can get email updates if you want. You can head on over to handgunworld.com. You can listen over there, listen to the audio version. And just the opposite, for those of you who are listening on audio right now, if you want to see our guns and what Dave and I are talking about, hop on over to Handgun World on YouTube and check it out. So for all my viewers, shoot straight, shoot safe, get that Bible out and read it every day, and let's continue on the audio podcasts.
We talked a little bit last week about defining our mission. Are we recording?
Yes, we are.
Okay. So, and a lot of the stuff I got is from these two books, a gentleman named Varg Freeborn. Let's see if you can see it.
Yeah, I see it. Varg Freeborn, Violence of Mind.
Violence of Mind. So that's where I got a lot of the defining your mission. And this one I'm working through, Beyond OODA, by Varg as well.
Same person.
So he's a very smart person. He is in the unique position where he actually was convicted of a felony and has done time in prison, but then he was able to get his rights restored because he successfully argued afterwards, after he knew the law, that the stabbing that got him put in prison was actually legal self-defense.
Good.
So he comes from it from a very unique position. But so we talk about define your mission. You want to define your mission, what you are willing to do, and then you build your program, your training program around that mission that you want to do. And specifically, one of the things that he mentions in Violence of Mind, and I reviewed that earlier to kind of get these details on it, as you are setting up your training and setting up your tactics, the way that you're going to respond, you must 100% incorporate the law into the way that you're going to respond.
Okay.
You absolutely have to. So you're not going to necessarily, you know, oh, if this guy comes out, I'm going to pull my gun and do a bill drill on him and shoot him 6 times. Because, you know, and this ties in, if you've taken one of Masada Yub's, the Mag 40 class, you know, you have to consider the law and what the law says about using deadly force for self-defense. And so Varg will talk about, like, everything you do, all your programming that you do for your responses and the way that you train, the way that you set up your shooting drills must absolutely be in compliance with the law. And the reason he says that is it's part of human nature that most people will see themselves as good and righteous. Mm-hmm. And so you will justify your actions by just your own righteousness, right? You see someone doing the wrong thing. Well, I'm the good guy and I'm going to go in there and stop him because what he's doing is wrong. But of course, we are fallible, and something that we might think is right may not be necessarily in compliance with the law.
Yeah, exactly. And the jury also may not think it's right.
Yeah. So he talks about that in Violence of Mind. He does some some case studies. But, you know, and Masada Yu will talk about this in Mag 40 as well. I feel like they interact, these two people, and it's interesting that they come to a lot of the same conclusions. But you want to, the reason that you base all your actions on the law, and then you stick with your training and really commit to following your mission, is because if you decide to do something that you have not practiced for,
yeah,
like that, you're going to be in trouble. You're going to be getting involved in a situation that you are not prepared to handle. You don't know what the options are. You don't know what your capabilities are. So you have to stick with whatever you've trained for.
That's a very good point.
So, and that would include, like, make sure that you are acting in a way that is justified legally.
So, you know, this is why I don't think anybody should end up in court after defending themselves with their handgun and have no training, because even if you were successful in defending yourself, you know, you're going to get hammered because you have no training.
Yeah, well, and we remember George Zimmerman, and I mean,
that poor guy.
Yeah. He followed the law exactly to a T, but almost on accident.
And this is what this is what can happen to you. And I'm not trying to scare people, because there's a lot of people out there, Dave, that are trying to scare people from a legal perspective. Oh, all these bad things are going to happen to you. And that's not necessarily true, but they can. So this is why I'm such a big proponent of training, and I have been for how long I've been doing this now? I've been doing this almost 13 years. I've been and that's why I've always, you know, pushed training so much, is because if your attorney in court can pull out a bunch of training certificates and say, look at my client, Bob Main, look how many hours of training that he's got.
Yeah.
That's probably an advantage.
I mean, it can be if it is legal.
If you're training yourself
to follow the law. Yeah.
If you're training yourself to follow the law, yes.
And that's where Masada Yub's the Mag 40 class is really just, the price that they charge for that is...
It's too cheap.
It's just way too cheap.
It's too cheap.
Because of what they'll do is, if you're ever involved in a defensive shooting,
yeah,
and it's justified, then Mass or someone from his group will come and be your expert witness for free.
Yes.
And he will help to educate the jury on all the things that you talked about in your class, that so that they understand things from your perspective.
And that's a big deal. That's a big deal, having someone who is an expert be your expert witness. There's a lot of people who do expert witness work and they're not really experts, you know. But they get called by lawyers, hey, can you come in and be an expert witness? Mass Ayub is an expert witness.
He is, and he's not getting younger. So I think everybody who's considering it, like, you need to go sign up, even if you have to take a cross-country trip. You should go take that class.
I've done it twice.
The man's living... He's a living legend. I mean, you should go meet
him. He is. If it's legal training, that's good. I'm glad you said that.
Yeah. So things like, you know, maybe you do a failure to stop drill, but then maybe you also say, okay, let's do two shots to the chest only.
Yeah.
Maybe just one shot, or one shot to the head target, and you maybe switch things up, and you want to, I've heard a lot of people say that about as much time as it takes you for you to process a new sight picture and process the reaction of the bad guy, you know, for some people it can be like a quarter a second to, you know, a 0.3 hundredths of a second. So you see people who are getting on there and they're doing 0.15 splits. It's like, could the defense attorney argue that you were so habituated to shooting so quickly that you couldn't actually process what you were seeing?
Well, I guess that's somewhat of a valid, I mean, that's, I shouldn't say it's a valid argument, but I should say it's probably one that the prosecutor would try to argue.
Yeah. But if you say, well, I try not to go faster than a third of a second, because from what I understand, I'm legally responsible for each bullet. And so I, you know, I fire a shot and I don't want to, you know, if the guy stops, I don't want to keep shooting him. I mean, yeah. Something to consider.
Dave, so, I want to make another recommendation. Go ahead. Finish sure. up your point.
Oh, I was going to say just we don't want to scare people away from defending themselves if their life is in danger. But Varg, having been to prison, the chapter 3 here, he says, if you fail, prison is a living death.
Wow.
It is as if you died, but you're still conscious. Everybody goes on around you. He's like, imagine you are stuck somewhere. Some other man is sleeping with your wife, buying clothes for your children, you know, walking them down the aisle at their wedding, or even worse, the guy is abusing your wife and your children, and there's nothing you can do about it.
Mm.
So that is the price of failure. It's not just, oh, you know, maybe I'll do some time in prison. It's the real deal. So that's why it is so, so important.
That's profound.
Yeah.
That is profound. I never thought of it that way. It's a living death. Wow. Whew.
Yeah, it's kind of heavy.
That is kind of heavy.
And he's in favor. He teaches people or has taught people to use deadly force in self-defense. But his said you must be 100% legally justified.
Yeah.
In taking the actions that you
I
take.
I totally agree. I totally agree. I have taken Masada Yub's Mag 40 class twice. Mm-hmm. And another one I'd like to recommend is The Law of Self-Defense, Andrew Branca.
Yes. Andrew Branca, yes.
This is my personally signed copy that Andrew signed for me. And you probably have one too, right? And
I don't have one from Branca, but I did get Varg's signature.
You got Varg. Okay, good. I would strongly recommend people read The Law of Self-Defense. And one of the things I like, first, I strongly recommend you go to Mag 40. Then
yes.
You should read or listen to this book. And I have had a chance to listen to Andrew speak at the Rangemaster Tactical Conference before, several years ago. One good thing about what Andrew does is he gets somewhat state-specific. Not in this book, but I think that part of his classes, like if he goes to your state, I think, maybe somebody will correct me, but he'll give you the material on the law of self-defense specific to your state.
Yeah. And from what I understand, Andrew is also a graduate of Mag 40.
He is a graduate. Oh, matter of fact, the foreword is by Masada Yub.
There you go.
The foreword of this book. So, yes, he is a graduate of, I believe he is. So all this stuff, the more you can educate yourself, I think there's two fights that you're going to have to win. The first fight is when you use this tool to save your life, and the second fight is in court.
Yes.
And I think you should be prepared for both fights.
Yeah, that's and you know, Mass and Varg both are Varg. His expertise is not so much in preparing you for that, but that is one of the principles. If you've taken a Mag 40, is that you legally you know where the attack is going to come from, and so you prepare a defense for it.
Yeah,
and build that into your actions.
Thanks for talking more about defining your mission. I just want to close with this and get your comment. I try to define my mission every time I put on a gun. And I cannot predict the future. Nobody can predict the future. But I have basically three scenarios that I prepare for, and I try the best I can to calculate. The first scenario is when I just did this a few days ago, when I'm going into a business situation where I'm conducting business in my real job. I may have to pocket carry a little tiny car P380 like this in a pocket holster.
Yeah.
That's a mission. The mission is I want to be absolutely 100% concealed. Nobody knows I have a gun on me. I'll even put this in my back pocket if I really want to conceal it. But I will have something in case the stink goes down. Okay?
Yep.
And I'm good with it. I'm good with it. I've shot this many times. My second mission is I might have something with a little bit higher capacity, like my P365, that has a 10 or a 12 round magazine. I usually don't go higher than 10 or 12 rounds. And here's my 12 round magazine. And this will be carried on my belt. My mission with this gun is I need a little bit more capacity. I need a little bit more smack. And maybe I'm planning on going to a place where, you know, I'm not so sure about the environment.
If it's a little more public.
Yeah. You know, and where even though I may print a little bit with this, my mission is still to make sure that nobody knows that I have a pistol on me. And I've been a lot of places with this P365 and nobody knew. Okay.
Yeah.
My last mission is if I'm going to have range fun, a training class, a competition match, or whatever, then I got a full size gun. Then I got a Glock 17 size with a 17 round mag. And this is typically, I'm never going to conceal this. Not a guy like me. So this is not a concealed carry mission. This is everything but concealed carry. Do you kind of break it down that way, or is it for you the same thing every time?
Well, I don't have as many different sizes of handguns as you do. I had a car, CM9, for a while, sold it to my brother a couple of Christmases ago. But, yeah, so with the guns that I have, they're all like this, the M&P, about the Glock 19 size, my SIG 229, similar dimensions.
That's similar to a Glock 19 size, yeah.
Yeah, you know, about a 15 round, like the 4-inch barrel, 15 round magazine. So yeah, I understand that. And there's trainers that I've known who, you know, if they are going somewhere where there may be a higher crime rate, or maybe they're doing a job or something, like a retired cop has been hired as to do a security guard.
Yeah, there you go.
They're going to do, you know, where they're maybe expecting
their mission's a lot different.
Yeah. Then they might carry the 365 XL or maybe, you know, something the Glock 19 size. Yeah. And a little bit more ammo because they're expecting that maybe if I get into something, this might be kind of protracted. But when they're just by themselves, just out with their spouse or whoever, and Daryl Bulkey is one that has mentioned this, that he just carries the J-frame to remind himself not to get involved in stuff.
That's like, pretty good. Like, I like that.
He's like, I've only got, you know, 5 or 6 shots. And so it's a reminder to him that he needs to pull back and be more evasive rather than aggressive. So that's a great point. I'm looking to get one of those new J-frame revolvers, the Lipsies.
Me too. I want one of those. They call them the UC, I guess, Ultimate Carry.
Ultimate Carry.
You can't find those things though.
They're getting out there. They're kind of percolating out. And Lipsies and Smith & Wesson, they've said that they're going to produce those things until they stop selling. So it's not going to be a limited run. It's going to be limited by just sales. So as they make their way out.
I suspect, you know, they'll be making those a long time then. Because
I sure hope.
Well, their demand is huge right now. I want one. You want one. I bet a lot of people listening to this want one. And the thing I like about them the most is I mean, I have never had a chance to handle one, but they're J-frame revolver size with six rounds instead of five.
Yeah, the 32s.
That's what I want. I want the 32.
Yeah, and I've heard the recoil is like, it's like shooting a 22.
Yeah, I want the 32. I want the 30, even though it means I have to stock some more of a different type of ammo. I want the 32 because there's so many different 32 cartridges you can shoot with that. And it's probably just going to be lighter weight and easier to carry than a 357 or 38.
Yeah, and so back to what you were saying, as far as like different, you know, environments that you're going to be, like maybe in your business environment, you would love the 65, the 365, but it'll be detected, right? Yeah,
this is sometimes a little too big, this P365. Yeah. I change it to the 10-round mag with the pinky extension that comes with it, even that is just a tad too big, so I got to step down to this.
Yeah, and I think that's perfectly acceptable. If you're going to go to a place where that's the best you can get, then that's the best you can get. And then you have to evaluate we got to be honest about, is a shooting going to break out? Am I going to be mugged there? Is somebody going to try something? And if it's, let's say, a business where it's kind of closed to the public, and we're going to get really dark here, but like you think about active shooters, they're trying to make a splash, right? And so they're trying to maximize that, you know, they have one shot, they're trying to maximize the shock. And so if it's somewhere that it's a business where they have maybe access control into the building where any person couldn't just wander in, probably less likely that the random active shooter is going to get in there.
You're probably right.
Less likely that you're going to get like robbed at gunpoint inside there. So,
yes,
you know, something just in case of emergency, because you never know. In case of emergency, you know, if the guy happens to appear around the corner while you're trying to escape, you can hit him a few times and disrupt his plans
and keep on getting out. And
get the heck out of there. Then I think, that little J-frame or a little, you know, P380 would be just fine.
Yeah. So go ahead.
Yeah. Well, I was just saying, it just depends on kind of where you're planning to go. Like, you know, the grocery stores here where I live are not like, it's not a high crime area, not a violent crime area, but it's also like if someone was going to do an active shooting, they would go somewhere where there's a lot of people. So, you know, maybe you have to weigh the risks. Like, is it worth it to get the bigger equipment and take it with me just to have the more capability, or maybe I just value being able to relax and just drop a gun in my pocket and not have to think about it too hard. And you know, it's just for getting me out of trouble.
Having said that, I've practiced enough with this little 380 and with my Glock 42. I've practiced enough. I can make the 15 to 20 yard shot with this. I've practiced That's enough. I can hit the guy's torso 15 to 20 yards, and I've got, you know, seven rounds to do it. So, so if it is an active shooter and I'm 15 yards from him or even a little bit less, I think I might be able to change his mind. Yeah. At least change his mind about trying to shoot me.
Yeah. Or, you know, disrupt whatever he happens to be aiming at. It's hard to aim when you're getting hit with rounds,
or it might buy me an opportunity to get the heck out of there.
Yeah, anything that is going to expand that time and make it hard for him to react to is going to be good for you. And then even with like a mugging situation, you can be like, okay, yeah, sure, here's my keys, I got my phone, I got my wallet back here, bang, whoops, you know,
What happened?
You would be so confused. But yeah, if you know, having something like that in your back pocket, it's really small where you can access and slip it out really quick. That would be useful for those situations as well, which is something you need to practice, that type of thing. And I would say look at Craig Douglas's class. They talk a lot about
another great one. Yeah. Dave, this is good stuff. Thanks again for coming back on. I want to let people know, if you have questions for me or Dave, just email them to me. I'll get them over to Dave. Dave likes to call in a lot of voicemails too, so maybe he'll answer you with a voicemail, or maybe I'll bring him on and do another interview. My email's handgunworld@gmail.com. And, you know, Dave, what's the last thought you want to leave with people?
The last thought, we do all these things so that we can live our life. And so while we need to be proficient and we need to train, we also need to get out there and just enjoy ourselves. Because, you know, it doesn't make sense to go through and have all these capabilities and then just be so wound up, so tight and negative and, you know, making this a bad experience, especially for like your family. You know, you want your family to be able to like you when we do all this stuff.
I love it. What a great way to end. You want to make sure your family still likes you. That's great. Yeah. That's awesome. Yeah. Everybody, Dave Somm joined me again, and I'm Bob Main. You've just listened to another excellent episode of the Handgun World Podcast. A couple of things before I sign off. You can get email updates just by going to handgunworld.com and signing up. You can get a free article that I wrote a few years back. The other thing is, please support me on Patreon. A link will be in the show notes. And if you want to see more stuff like this coming to you. And last but not least, make sure you shoot straight, shoot safe, know the laws. Know the laws of where you are, like Dave and I just talked about. And thanks again for coming on, sir. I appreciate that. Have a good one.
Thank you. You too.
Take care.
Good afternoon. This is your captain speaking with just a little flight information. Coming up on the left, we're going to be catching a glimpse of the Grand Canyon. On the right, you can be able to see the Hoover Dam in just a few minutes. We're flying at an altitude of 37,000 feet, and our airspeed is 400 miles an hour. Couple little facts here. I'm packing a Colt King Cobra. That's a 357 caliber firearm with a black rubber grip and a 6-inch barrel. Also, the co-pilot is carrying a Kimber custom defense pistol with all the bells and whistles you'd expect from a custom gun of that kind, with an alloy frame and bevel treatment on the entire gun. And our chief flight attendant, Roger, has a Ruger Bearcat a 22 with a hand-fluted cylinder. All three are capable of piercing body armor at a distance of up to 27 feet, and it can put a hole in human bone and flesh the size of the Grand Canyon, which, by the way, is coming up on the left-hand side of the plane, so just sit back and relax and enjoy the rest of the flight.